Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into aviation meteorology.
Specifically, using a manual for private pilots here in New Zealand as our guide.
Right. And the goal isn't to make you a meteorologist overnight.
No, definitely not. It's about understanding the weather from a pilot's perspective, decoding that specialized language.
Pulling out what's crucial for flying safely or even just, you know, understanding the atmosphere better.
We want to translate all those reports and forecasts, the physics, into something useful.
So this deep dive is really designed to give you a fast track to grasping the core ideas from this kind of source material.
Consider it a primer on the language of the sky.
Okay, first off, pilots have access to a lot of weather information, right? Like through MetFlight here in NZ.
Oh, absolutely. There's a whole suite of products. You've got reports like MEDARS, Specious, Otter the Port.
Those are the actuals, the conditions right now.
Exactly. Then forecasts like TAFs, trends, and graphical stuff too.
Like GRIFORS, those area charts.
Yeah, GRIFORS, GNZ, SWX for significant weather, GSM for SIGMET monitoring, plus things like ATIS and AWIB at airfields.
So a lot of acronyms, a lot of specific formats. Let's break down the language they use, starting with units. Wind speed.
Always in knots. Non-negotiable in aviation.
Okay, knots. What about direction? That can be a bit tricky, can it?
It can. Met Service, the main provider, gives wind direction in degrees true. So relative to true north.
But what you hear from the tower.
Right. Air traffic control spot winds or the ATIS broadcast at an airport that's typically degrees magnetic.
And here in New Zealand, magnetic north is quite different from true north.
It is. You need to subtract roughly 20 to 25 degrees from the true direction to get the magnetic direction, depending on where you are exactly. Crucial difference.
And wind direction always tells you where the wind is coming from, correct?
Yes. Always from. A 270 wind is coming from the west.
Okay. Visibility. How's that reported?
In meters. Up to 900, 999 meters, typically.
But sometimes you see kilometers.
At the bigger airports, Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, if visibility is 10 kilometers or more, they'll report it in whole kilometers, like 10 kilometers.
Altitude and height.
Always feet. And it's important whether it's above mean sea level, AMSL, or above ground level, AGL. Cloud bases, for instance, are usually AGL.
And pressure, the bases for altimeters.
Hectopascals, HPA. Usually rounded down in reports.
Right, let's tackle some of those codes you see in reports. Cloud amount.
Measured in octas, that's eighths of the sky covered by cloud.
So you get codes like FUW.
BFUW is few, 1 to 2 octas. SCT is scattered, 3 to 4. BKN is broken, 5 to 7 octas.
And OVC.
Overcast. 8 out of 8 octas, the whole sky. SKC means sky clear, and NSC means no significant cloud.
You also mentioned KVO earlier. That sounds like good news.
It is. Stands for cloud and visibility. Okay. Specific criteria, though.
Which are?
Visibility 10 kilometers or more, no nasty clouds like SIB or TCU anywhere.
KIB is cumulonimbus, TCU towering cumulus.
Exactly. And no other cloud below 5,000 feet AGL or below the highest minimum sector altitude for that airport, whichever is higher. Basically, really good VFR conditions at major airports.
What about cloud types in reports? Do they list everything?
Generally, no. In meters and TAFs, they really only single out the significant ones, TCU and CLIB, because of the hazards.
And sometimes automatic stations can't tell.
Right. If an automatic weather station, AWS, detects cloud but can't figure out the type, you'll just see 3 slashes after the height.
Speaking of height, cloud bases are reported how?
In hundreds of feet above ground level. So if you see BKN025, that means broken cloud with the base at 2,500 feet AGL.
Got it. And then there are codes for the actual weather itself.
Yep. Quite a list. Yeah. Like TS for thunderstorm, RA for rain, SH for shower, FG for fog. SHRA is a moderate shower of rain. BCFG means patches of fog.
And if nothing significant is happening,
you'll see NSW nil, significant weather.
Forecasts like TFSS often show changes happening over time. How are those indicated?
They use specific change indicators. Tempo means temporary changes, expected to last less than an hour in total for each instance.
So brief periods of different weather.
Yeah. BECMG means becoming a more gradual, permanent change expected during the specified time period.
Okay. And prob?
Probability. Prob 30 or prob 40 indicates a 30% or 40% chance of a specific condition, like a thunderstorm, occurring.
And timing codes. FM, TL, AT.
FM is from, TL is until, AT is at a specific time. These define the validity periods for the main forecast or the changes.
There's also the trend forecast.
Ah, yes, the trend. That's a short 2-hour forecast tacked on to the end of a METAR or SPECI report at certain airfields. And it's important for its 2-hour validity period. The trend takes precedence over the main path.
So it's a more immediate updated forecast for the next couple of hours.
Exactly. Very useful for short-term planning.
And this highlights a really key difference, doesn't it, between reports and forecasts?
Absolutely crucial. METARs, SPECs, auto reports, they tell you what was happening at the time of observation. They're historical data the moment they're issued.
Whereas TAFs and trends are predictions of the future.
Correct. You cannot use a METAR as a forecast for what's coming next unless it has that trend attached. Big mistake to treat a report like a forecast.
You mentioned graphical products, too. Gray 4s and the like.
Yeah, they give you a visual map view. Gray 4s show forecast conditions over specific regions or routes. GNZSI WX charts highlight significant weather hazards across the country. They help you see the bigger picture.
So pulling this section together, understanding this sort of weather alphabet soup, the codes, the units, the report types, it's the essential first step, isn't it?
It really is. It allows you to translate all that raw data into a meaningful picture of what the atmosphere is actually doing or is expected to do, whether you're planning a flight or just curious about the clouds overhead.
Okay, let's shift gears now. Move from the language of reports to the underlying physics. Pressure, wind, layers of the atmosphere.
The fundamentals that make it all happen. Let's start with atmospheric pressure.
We kind of take it for granted, but what is it?
Simply put, it's the weight of the entire column of air pressing down on a particular spot.
And it's surprisingly heavy.
Immense. About 1 kilogram per square centimeter at sea level. That works out to roughly 10 tons pressing down on every square meter.
10 tons. Wow. So why aren't we crushed?
Because pressure acts in all directions, not just downwards. But for aviation, it's absolutely vital.
For altimeters, right?
Exactly. Altimeters are basically pressure gauges calibrated to show altitude. They measure the ambient air pressure and convert it based on a setting.
And vertical speed indicators.
They measure the rate of pressure change. As you climb, pressure drops. As you descend, it increases. The VSI shows how quickly that's happening. So understanding pressure changes horizontally and vertically is fundamental.
And pressure always decreases as you go up.
Always. That's a key principle. Air pressure must always decrease with increasing height. This is the pressure lapse rate.
How fast does it decrease?
Near the surface, say below 10,000 feet, it's roughly 1 hectopascal for every 30 feet you climb, give or take.
This is why setting the altimeter correctly is so critical for safety, using QNH or QFE.
Precisely. QNH is the setting that makes your altimeter read your altitude above mean sea level. QFE makes it read your height above the specific airfield elevation.
Get that wrong, especially near the ground.
And you could be significantly higher or lower than you think. Very dangerous. Correct subscale setting is non-negotiable.
Okay, let's talk wind. How is the standard aviation wind measured and reported?
Standard measurement is from a 10-meter mast averaged over 10 minutes. Met Service reports it in knots and, as we said, degrees true.
Why true north for Met Service?
Because they're forecasting over large areas where magnetic variation changes. True north is constant. ATC uses magnetic because pilots navigate using magnetic headings near airports.
And near the surface, what makes the wind blow? 3 main forces.
That's right. At lower levels, it's a combination of the pressure gradient force, the Coriolis force, and friction.
Pressure gradient force. That's air moving from high to low pressure.
Exactly. Air naturally wants to flow from high pressure areas to low pressure areas to try and equalize things. The gradient is how quickly pressure changes over distance.
And on a weather map, that's shown by the isobars.
Yes, lines of equal pressure. Where isobars are packed closely together, the pressure changes rapidly over a short distance that's a strong pressure gradient, and it means strong winds, like air rushing out of a tire.
Okay, then the Coriolis force, that's due to the Earth spinning.
Correct. It doesn't cause the wind, but it deflects moving air to the left in the southern hemisphere, to the right in the northern.
Like trying to throw a ball straight on a merry-go-round?
Kind of like that, yeah. It acts perpendicular to the wind direction, and its effect increases with wind speed and with latitude stronger near the poles, zero at the equator.
So if you ignore friction for a moment, high up.
High up, above the friction layer, the pressure gradient force, PGF, pushing air towards low pressure, and the Coriolis force pulling it to the left reach a balance, assuming straight isobars.
And the wind blows parallel to the isobars.
That's the theoretical geostrophic wind. Parallel to straight isobars, with low pressure on the right in the southern hemisphere, its speed is directly related to the isobar spacing closer isobars, stronger geostrophic wind.
But down near the ground, friction messes things up.
It does. The surface trees, buildings, hills, even rough seas creates drag, slowing the wind down.
And if the wind slows down,
the Coriolis force, which depends on speed, weakens. Now the PGF is stronger relative to Coriolis.
So the wind doesn't stay parallel to the isobars?
No, the imbalance allows the wind to flow across the isobars towards the lower pressure.
How much does it turn?
Depends on how rough the surface is. Over smooth sea, maybe only 10 or 20 degrees. Over flat land, typically around 30 degrees. Over really rough mountainous terrain, it's much more complex. But the principle holds surface wind is slower and angled across the isobars compared to the wind, just a bit higher up.
The source mentioned a rule of thumb, surface wind speed versus higher wind.
Yeah, often about two-thirds the speed of the wind at, say, 2,000 feet, and turned about 30 degrees towards the low from that higher wind direction. It's a generalization, but useful.
This whole rough, turbulent layer near the ground is called the friction layer.
That's the one. It's where surface friction causes turbulence and affects wind speed and direction.
How deep is it?
It varies a lot. Maybe only a few hundred feet to 1,000 feet over the sea. Perhaps 2,000 feet over flat land, maybe 3,000 feet over towns.
But over mountains.
Ah, mountains are different. Downwind of major ranges, especially in strong winds, that turbulent layer can extend way up 15,000 feet or even higher sometimes. Turbulence is a defining feature of this layer.
So as a pilot, climbing out or descending?
Generally, climbing out of the friction layer, you'll find the wind speed increases and the direction veers turns clockwise, more parallel to the isobars.
And descending into it?
The opposite. Speed decreases and the direction backs turns anti-clockwise, more across the isobars towards the low. That 30-degree shift is a decent average, but local effects can dominate.
There's also Bayes-Ballot's law.
A classic rule. In the southern hemisphere, stand with your back to the wind, and the center of the low-pressure system is generally on your right.
Does friction change that?
Slightly. The source suggests turning about 30 degrees anti-clockwise after putting your back to the surface wind, then the low center is 90 degrees to your right. But again, use with caution in mountains.
Now let's look vertically at the atmosphere's structure. Where does all the weather actually happen?
Almost entirely in the lowest layer, the troposphere.
That's where we live.
It is. It extends from the surface up to, well, it varies, but around 30-odd thousand feet in our latitudes. It's characterized by constant motion, both horizontal and vertical, and it contains about 75% of the atmosphere's total mass.
And temperature generally decreases with height in the troposphere.
Yes, that's the typical environmental lapse rate, or ELR. Gets colder as you go up.
What's above the troposphere?
It's a triple S. It acts like a boundary or a lid. It's defined as the point where the temperature stops decreasing with height, or maybe even starts increasing slightly.
Its height isn't constant.
No, it's higher over the equator, lower over the poles, and generally higher in summer than in winter.
And above the tropopause.
You enter the lower stratosphere. Here, the temperature often stays constant or increases slowly with height. It's very stable, very dry, almost no water vapor, essentially perpetually fine weather above the tropopause.
Okay, so understanding these fundamentals, pressure, the forces driving wind, the friction layer, and knowing weather lives in the troposphere gives us the why behind the reports we see, right?
Exactly. It helps make sense of why the wind changes with height, why altimeter settings are critical, and where to expect weather phenomena.
Now let's dive into how weather forms. Stability, moisture, clouds, precipitation.
Yeah, the ingredients and processes. Stability is a really core concept.
How do we think about stability? The manual uses an invisible balloon or bubble analogy.
That's a good way to picture it. Imagine a parcel of air being forced to rise. Its stability depends on whether it ends up warmer or colder than the air surrounding it at its new height.
If it's warmer than the surrounding air.
It's less dense, like a hot air balloon, so it wants to keep rising on its own. That indicates an unstable atmosphere, one that promotes vertical movement.
If it's colder?
It's denser, heavier than the surroundings, so it will tend to sink back down if the lifting force stops. That's a stable atmosphere, one that resists vertical motion.
This relates back to the environmental lapse rate, the ELR.
Yes. The ELR tells us how the temperature of the surrounding air is changing with height. A positive lapse rate means it gets colder with height, which is normal.
But sometimes it gets warmer, an inversion.
Right. An inversion is where temperature increases with height. That's a very stable layer. rising air hitting an inversion struggles to punch through. An isothermal layer, where temperature stays constant with height, is also stable.
You mentioned conditional instability earlier.
Yeah.
That sounds conditional.
It is. It depends on moisture. Imagine lifting that air parcel again. If it's dry, it cools at a certain rate as it rises and expands. It might reach a level where it's colder than the environment and stop rising, stable or neutral.
But if it's moist?
If it's moist enough, as it rises and cools, it will eventually reach its dew point and water vapor will condense into cloud droplets. Now, here's the key. Condensation releases latent heat.
Ah, the hidden heat energy.
Exactly. This released heat warms the air parcel internally. Suddenly, even though it's rising and cooling overall, this extra heat boost can make it warmer than the surrounding air.
Making it unstable.
Yes, it gets that extra kick and accelerates upwards. So the atmosphere might be stable for dry air, but unstable if rising air is moist enough to condense. That's conditional instability conditional on saturation occurring.
Moisture is clearly key. Where does it come from?
Primarily water vapor, evaporated from oceans, lakes, rivers, wet ground. Also, transpiration from plants releasing moisture.
And you also need aerosols, tiny particles.
Yes, microscopic things like salt from sea spray, dust, smoke particles. They act as condensation nuclei surfaces for the water vapor to condense onto to form cloud droplets. Most aerosols originate near the surface.
We mentioned latent heat release during condensation. Does it work the other way?
Yes. Evaporation, liquid to gas, absorbs heat, cooling the surroundings. Melting, solid to liquid, also absorbs heat.
But condensation, deposition, vapor straight to ice like frost, and freezing, liquid to ice, all release latent heat.
Correct. And that release of heat is a major energy source in the atmosphere, particularly important for fueling cloud development, especially big convective clouds like thunderstorms.
So putting it together, how do clouds form?
Basic process. One, air rises. Two, as it rises, it moves into lower pressure, so it expands and cools adiabatically. Three, it cools to its dew point temperature, becoming saturated. Four, water vapor condenses onto available aerosols, forming tiny cloud droplets or ice crystals. Voila, a cloud.
Clouds have different names based on appearance and formation, right?
Yeah.
Cumulus, stratus.
Yeah, the main classifications help describe them. Cumulus or cumulo implies a heap-like puffy cloud formed by convection, rising thermals. Think cotton wool balls.
Stratus or strato.
Means layer or sheet. These are flat, featureless clouds, often formed by slow, widespread lifting.
Other prefixes, alto.
Nimbo.
Zero.
Alto means middle-level clouds, roughly 6,500 to 20,000 feet. Nimbo, or nimbus, means it's a rain-producing cloud. Cirrus, or cirro, refers to high-level clouds, above 20,000 feet, which are composed of ice crystals and look thin and wispy.
And what makes the air rise in the first place? The lifting mechanisms.
Several main ways. Orographic lift is air being forced upwards as it encounters hills or mountains. Very important in NZ.
Convection.
That's thermal activity. Pockets of air heated by the sunlit ground become buoyant and rise. If they rise high enough and have enough moisture, you get cumulus clouds. If the air is dry, you can still have blue thermals rising air without cloud.
Turbulence can cause lift.
Yes, mechanical turbulence. Air flowing over rough ground or obstacles gets tumbled around, and some eddies move upwards, potentially forming low, ragged cloud.
And widespread ascent.
That's large-scale lifting, often associated with weather systems like fronts or low-pressure areas, leading to extensive layers of cloud like stratus or nimbostratus.
Let's touch on some common cloud types and what they mean for pilots. Stratocumulus, SC.
A low-level layer cloud, but with some lumpiness or texture, often looks like rolls or patches, can produce light drizzle or rain, might have light to moderate rime icing if temperatures are below freezing, usually light turbulence, perhaps a bit bumpy near the top or base, especially if there's an inversion nearby.
Stratocy.
A uniform, gray, featureless, low-level layer often brings drizzle and significantly reduced visibility, sometimes resembling fog that hasn't reached the ground. Icing is usually nil unless temps are well below zero. Turbulence is generally light. Big issue is the low ceiling and poor visibility.
Cumulus.
The classic fair weather puffy clouds generally indicate rising air. Small ones, cumulus, are benign. Larger ones, mediocris, congestus, can develop into towering cumulus.
TC and TC can produce.
Showers. TC and especially cumulonimbus subi contain significant hazards. Moderate to severe turbulence within and below the cloud. Potential for moderate glaze icing, clear ice if temperatures are right, and heavy precipitation.
Cree is the thunderstorm clouds, one to really avoid.
Absolutely. All the hazards of TCU, but amplified. Severe turbulence, severe icing, heavy rain, hail, lightning, everything you don't want to fly through in a light aircraft.
Precipitation, the stuff falling out.
Water in liquid or solid form falling from a cloud and reaching the ground. If it evaporates before reaching the ground, it's called virga, those streaks you sometimes see below clouds.
Types, rain, drizzle.
Rain, liquid drops. In NZ, most rain actually starts as snow high up in the cloud and melts on the way down. Drizzle, very small drops, almost mist-like, typically falls from stratus cloud and severely reduces visibility.
Snow, sleet, hail.
No, ice crystals needs the freezing level to be quite low. Sleet, a mixture of rain and partially melted snow, usually when surface temp is just above freezing, 1-2 degrees C hail. Lumps of ice formed the strong updrafts and downdrafts within a C cloud can range from small pellets to large stones.
And there's a difference between continuous rain and showers.
Yes. Continuous or intermittent precipitation usually falls from layered stratiform clouds like nimbostratus or altostratus. It tends to be steadier and cover a larger area. Showers fall from convective cumuliform clouds like TCU or Seibi. They are typically more localized, start and stop abruptly, and can change intensity rapidly. Visibility can drop dramatically in a heavy shower.
So this section links the invisible processes like latent heat to the visible weather, clouds, rain, snow.
Right. Understanding latent heat helps explain the energy in storms. Knowing cloud types gives you a vital heads up about potential turbulence, icing, and the type and intensity of precipitation you might encounter.
Okay, let's focus now on specific hazards that pose major risks, starting with visibility.
Critical for VFR flight, obviously. We measure prevailing visibility from the ground, the greatest distance visible throughout at least half the horizon.
It reduces it. Precipitation is a big one.
Definitely. Heavy rain, snow, even moderate drizzle can significantly cut visibility. Fog and mist are basically clouds on the ground, tiny water droplets scattering light.
Haze and smoke.
Smaller dry particles, dust, salt, pollution that reduce clarity. Sea spray, especially in strong onshore winds, can create a salty haze and coat windscreens. Blowing snow is another obvious one.
And sun glare.
Surprisingly significant. Even with clear air, flying towards a low sun can make it almost impossible to see ahead. Sunglasses, visors, even choosing a different runway direction can help mitigate it.
You mentioned slant range visibility earlier. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, it's the visibility along your actual line of sight from the cockpit. Looking straight down might be fine, but looking ahead at an angle through haze or precipitation could be much worse than the reported ground visibility.
The manual highlights a specific danger with haze layers on approach.
Yes, this is critical. You might be descending through a haze layer, able to see vertically downwards reasonably well, but the airfield itself or obstacles ahead can completely disappear in the slant path through the haze. Then suddenly, they reappear when you're much closer.
That sounds like a recipe for a controlled flight into terrain if you're not careful.
Exactly. You must be aware of minimum safe altitudes and have a clear go-around plan if you lose visual reference or aren't certain of your position and clearance from obstacles.
Fog, the ultimate visibility reducer.
Can drop visibility below 100 meters sometimes? Huge impact on airport operations.
Different types form in different ways. Radiation fog.
That's the common one forming overnight under clear skies, light winds, and with moisture near the surface. The ground radiates heat away, cools the air above it to its dew point, and fog forms. Usually dissipates or lifts into low stratus cloud after sunrise as the ground heats up.
Advection fog.
Forms when warm, moist air moves horizontally, advects, over a colder surface like moist sea air moving over cold land, or warm air moving over snow cover. Sea fog rolling inland is often advection fog.
Other types mentioned.
Steam fog, cold air over warm water, and frontal fog associated with precipitation near fronts are also listed. Main point. Fog severely restricts visibility.
Let's move to icing. The manual seems to really emphasize the dangers.
It does, and for very good reason, especially for PPL level operations in non-icing certified aircraft.
Yeah.
The list of potential effects is sobering.
Like decreased lift, increased drag.
Decreased thrust, increased weight, increased stall speed, potential for severe airframe damage, engine power loss or failure, induction icing, blocked pitot tubes giving false airspeed readings, restricted control surfaces, poor visibility through the windscreen.
That's a lot of ways for things to go wrong.
It really is. Any one of those is bad. Combinations can be catastrophic.
Different types of ice form.
Hoarfrost forms on parked aircraft surfaces, usually overnight when surfaces cool below freezing and below the frost point of the air. Looks white, crystalline. It disrupts airflow significantly, even a thin layer. Must be completely removed before flight. It's been implicated in many takeoff accidents.
Clear ice, or glaze ice,
forms when large supercooled water droplets strike the aircraft and freeze relatively slowly, spreading back as a clear or translucent, hard, tenacious sheet of ice. Typically forms in temperatures just below freezing, 0 degrees C to about negative 10 degrees C. Hard to see, hard to remove.
Rime ice.
Forms when smaller, supercooled droplets freeze instantly on impact, trapping air. Looks milky white or opaque, is more brittle than clear ice. Usually forms at colder temperatures, say negative 10 degrees to negative 20 degrees C. It builds forward into the airflow.
And mixed ice.
A combination of clear and rime, often forming between negative 5 degrees C and negative 15 degrees C.
The key ingredient seems to be supercooled water droplets.
Absolutely. Liquid water existing at temperatures below 0 degrees C. Clouds are full of them, especially between 0 degrees C and about negative 15 degrees C. The aircraft flying through acts as a freezing nucleus, and bam, the water freezes on impact.
So flight in cloud above the freezing level is inherently risky.
Yes, especially in clouds with significant vertical development like TCU and SEAV, which have strong updrafts lifting lots of supercooled water.
The manual's advice for PPL pilots.
Unequivocal. Avoid flight in known or forecast icing conditions unless the aircraft is properly certified and equipped and the pilot is trained and current for it. For most light GA aircraft, that means staying out of icing conditions altogether.
What about carburetor icing? That can happen even when it's not freezing outside.
Yes, that's a different mechanism. It's caused by fuel vaporization and pressure drop within the carburetor's venturi, which causes significant cooling.
Cooling enough to freeze moisture from the intake air.
Exactly. Water vapor in the air entering the engine can freeze inside the carb, blocking airflow and causing engine roughness or failure.
What conditions favor?
Can occur in outside air temperatures up to plus 20 degrees C or even slightly higher if humidity is high. The worst range is typically between about 0 degrees C and plus 15 degrees C with visible moisture or high humidity.
Does throttle setting matter?
Yes, it's often worse at lower power settings like idle or during descent because the throttle butterfly is more closed, increasing the venturi cooling effect. It can even form while taxiing on the ground.
Carb heat is the solution?
It's the primary defense. Carb heat directs hot, unfiltered air from around the exhaust manifold into the carburetor intake. This melts any ice, but also makes the intake air less dense, causing a noticeable drop in engine RPM when applied. Using it also carries a small risk of ingesting dust or debris since the air isn't filtered.
Thunderstorms, cumulonimbus clouds, what makes them form?
Three essential ingredients. One, plenty of moisture. Two, an unstable atmosphere, so rising air keeps rising vigorously. Three, a trigger mechanism to get the air rising in the first place, like surface heating, orographic lift, or a front.
And that latent heat release we talked about fuels them.
Massively. As water vapor condenses in the strong updrafts, the released latent heat warms the air further, making it even more buoyant, driving even stronger updrafts, a powerful feedback loop.
What are the main hazards associated with thunderstorms? The source lists 8.
Yes, and they're all serious. Hail can be large enough to severely damage aircraft. Lightning, severe turbulence, strong enough to cause structural failure. Gust fronts, sudden violent wind shifts ahead of the storm. Tornadoes, possible, though less common in NZ. Downbursts, microbursts, intense localized downdrafts causing extreme wind shear. Heavy rain, reducing visibility to near zero. And severe icing due to the abundance of supercooled water and strong updrafts.
Any one of those sounds bad enough.
Exactly. And you rarely get just one. The combination is what makes thunderstorms so incredibly dangerous for all aircraft, but especially light GA aircraft.
So the advice is?
Avoid them completely. Don't fly into them, under them, or even near them. Give them a very wide berth. The turbulence can extend many miles outside the visible cloud.
You mentioned microbursts and gust fronts specifically.
Microbursts are a particularly dangerous form of wind shear. A concentrated column of air plunges downwards and spreads out violently upon hitting the ground. Flying into one on approach or takeoff can result in a sudden loss of airspeed and altitude that might be impossible to recover from near the ground.
And gust fronts.
That's the leading edge of the cool downdraft air spreading out horizontally from the thunderstorm. It acts like a mini cold front, bringing a sudden shift in wind direction, a strong increase in wind speed, and significant turbulence. It can arrive well before the main storm and associated precipitation, sometimes marked by a roll cloud, but not always visible, especially if the outflow air is dry.
Okay, final specific hazard area, mountain weather. Hugely relevant for New Zealand.
Absolutely fundamental. Our topography dominates local weather patterns.
Big difference between windward and leeward sides.
Dramatic difference. On the windward side, facing the wind, air is forced up, It cools, forms cloud, often with low bases clinging to the slopes, and produces precipitation. Visibility is often poor in cloud and precipitation, and you can expect light to moderate turbulence.
Lee side, downwind.
Air sinks, compresses, warms, and dries out. Cloud tends to dissipate below ridge level. Bases lift. Visibility is generally much better. Sounds good, but
There's a catch.
turbulence. The lee side is notorious for potentially severe turbulence, especially in strong winds blowing across the ranges.
What kind of lee side turbulence?
You can get rotor zones, areas of extreme rotational turbulence below ridge level, often marked by ragged rotor clouds if there's enough moisture, but potentially severe even in clear air. These are incredibly dangerous.
Venturi effect.
Wind getting squeezed and accelerated through mountain passes or narrow valleys. Stable air layers flowing over mountains can also create mountain waves. Large up and down drafts extending high above the mountains, sometimes marked by smooth, lens-shaped lenticular clouds,
And the up-down draft themselves.
can be very strong, easily exceeding the climb or descent performance of a light aircraft. You could find yourself unable to maintain altitude or even being forced down towards terrain. Also, your lower ground speed when flying in mountains means you spend longer in these hazardous zones.
Visibility in mountains.
Can be challenging. Poor on the windward side in cloud precip. Generally good on the lee side, but watch out for virga creating localized areas of reduced visibility or blowing dust sand in dry conditions. Visual illusions are also common. Slopes can look less steep, distances can be deceptive, and losing the horizon is a real risk.
And mountain weather changes fast.
Very rapidly. Conditions can deteriorate much quicker than over flat terrain.
So, summarizing these hazards: visibility failure, icing dangers, airframe and CARB, thunderstorms as absolute no-go zones, and the complex, often severe, conditions in mountains. Understanding and respecting these is paramount.
Couldn't agree more. These are the sharp end of aviation weather risks.
Right, let's try and pull all these threads together now. How do these concepts apply to the broader weather systems we see affecting New Zealand?
Good plan. NZ's weather is really shaped by three main things: our latitude, mid-latitudes mean variable, changeable weather, our oceanic surroundings, lots of moisture available, maritime climate, and crucially, our topography, the mountains.
We get highs and lows moving across the country. Anticyclones or highs?
Generally associated with sinking air, so often fine, settled weather, light winds, seems good for flying.
But the source warns about them.
Yes, paradoxically, highs are often linked to GA accidents in NZ. Why? Because they can trap moisture near the surface, leading to persistent areas of low cloud, fog, or drizzle, especially in coastal or valley areas. Conditions can look okay inland, but be completely unflyable VFR near the coast or in certain valleys due to low ceilings trapped under an inversion associated with the high.
So, fine weather in a high doesn't always mean good flying weather everywhere.
Precisely, you need to check specifics.
Depressions or lows?
Associated with rising air, cloud, precipitation, and usually stronger winds because the isobars are packed closer together. They circulate clockwise here in the Southern Hemisphere.
And they interact with the mountains.
Dramatically. A low might stall against the Southern Alps, weaken or fill in on the windward side, but then intensify again or redevelop as a new center on the lee side.
How does the direction the wind comes from typically affect NZ weather, given our mountains? Let's start with a southerly.
A southerly flow brings cold maritime polar MP air northwards over relatively warmer land and sea surfaces. This heating from below destabilizes the air mass.
Meaning to.
Convective clouds, cumulus, towering cumulus, cumulonimbus. Expect showers of rain or hail, maybe snow if it's cold enough. Visibility will be poor in those showers, good in between. It will likely be quite turbulent due to the instability.
Okay, what about a northerly?
Opposite situation. Warm, moist, maritime, tropical MT air flowing southwards over progressively colder sea surfaces. This cools the air from below, making it stable.
Stable air means layered clouds.
Yes, expect extensive sheets of stratus, altostratus, nimbus stratus. This often brings continuous or intermittent rain or drizzle rather than showers. Visibility is often poor and murky, not just from the rain, but because pollutants get trapped near the surface in the stable air.
Westerlies are pretty common, aren't they?
Well, it's very common. often associated with lows passing south of NZ and highs to the north or over the Tasman. The typical pattern is several days of windy, often wet conditions on the west coast, while the east coast is also windy but generally fine and dry due to the phone effect lee of the ranges.
I'll log by.
Usually followed by a couple of days of finer, lighter winds as a ridge moves over, then the westerly pattern tends to repeat. Turbulence can be significant on the east coast in a westerly, especially near the ranges. West coast weather in summer westerlies is generally better than in winter.
And easterlies, sometimes called beasterly easterlies.
Often associated with slow-moving blocking highs positioned to the south or southeast of NZ with lows to the north. This setup forces a persistent easterly flow onto the country.
What does that bring?
Often prolonged periods of poor weather, low cloud, rain, drizzle to the east coast from Northland right down through Hawke's Bay, Oarapa, Canterbury, Otago, can cause significant flooding.
Meanwhile, the west coast
often gets brilliant sunshine and clear skies, although it can be very windy and turbulent right against the ranges. So easterlies have very different effects on opposite coasts.
Beyond these large-scale flows, local winds matter too. Sea breezes.
Very common around NZ coasts on fine days, the land heats up faster than the sea, creating lower pressure inland, drawing cooler air onshore from the sea.
When do these start?
Usually kick in mid-morning, push inland during the afternoon, often reaching quite far. Coriolis effect makes them turn anti-clockwise during the day, backing from NE to NW on an east coast, for example. They can sometimes trigger afternoon showers or thunderstorms if the air mass is unstable enough.
Katabatic winds.
That's cold air draining downhill off slopes and into valleys at night due to radiative cooling. Can lead to fog or frost in valley bottoms.
Terrain channeling.
Wind being funneled and accelerated through narrow valleys or straits, like Cook Strait or the Manawatu Gorge. The Venturi effect. Stability can enhance this effect. Local obstructions like hills or even large buildings create turbulence and downdrafts downwind.
When assessing all this, pilots use tools like satellite and radar imagery. What do they show?
Satellite images give the big picture. Infrared IR imagery works day and night, showing cloud top temperatures useful for identifying high cloud, deep convective clouds, fronts, and circulation centers. But it can struggle with low cloud or fog, which might have similar temperatures to the ground.
Visible imagery.
Works only in daylight, obviously. Shows clouds as we'd see them from space, very good for seeing the extent and texture of low and mid-level cloud. Combining visible and IR gives the best overview.
And radar?
Shows precipitation where it's raining or snowing, how intensely and how the precipitation areas are moving. Great for tracking showers or rain bands.
Limitations.
Radar beams travel in straight lines, so due to Earth's curvature, they overshoot low-level precipitation far from the radar site. Predicting exact arrival times can be tricky for widespread rain, but individual showers often move more predictably with the steering wind.
And a quick reminder about non-aviation forecasts, TV, newspapers.
Useful for general awareness, but not suitable for flight planning.
Mm-hmm.
Newspaper forecasts are often 12, 24 hours old by the time you read them. TV forecasts are general, lack aviation-specific detail, like freezing levels, cloud bases in feet, and aren't updated continuously like aviation sources. Always use official aviation weather products.
Okay, the crucial step, putting it all together for making a flight decision. What's the process?
Starts with thorough planning. Know your route, check charts for terrain and minimum safe altitudes, MSAs, then access all the relevant current aviation weather information from a source like MetFlight.
Not just the TAF for the destination.
No, look at the big picture, first synoptic charts, satellite radar, then drill down. Gray Force for the route, TAFs and METARs with trends for departure, destination, and potential alternates. Check SIGMETs for significant hazards. Note specific forecast details, wind, visibility, cloud base stops, icing levels, turbulence.
And then compare that to?
Critically compare the forecast and reported conditions against your own personal minimums, what conditions you are comfortable and safe flying in, and the legal requirements like VFR minima and MSA for the route.
The manual gives a great example. A planned flight from Hamilton to Paraparamo.
Yes, it illustrates the process well. The forecasts, TFs, Area 4, might have suggested generally okay conditions perhaps with showers increasing later?
But a key detail was the reported visibility versus forecast.
Exactly. The forecast might have said 20-30 kilometer visibility, but the actual METARs near the coast were reporting only 12-13 kilometers. The reason was strong westerly winds kicking up sea spray. That's a critical observation. The reality was already worse than the broad forecast indicated for that specific factor.
And the most critical factor for that route.
The forecast for low cloud over the high ground south of Taranaki and Ruapehu, the Tiger Country, the forecast cloud base was below the pilot's personal minimum safe altitude for flight over that terrain.
So even if the destination forecast was okay, the road itself wasn't safe.
Correct. Based on the forecast cloud over the mountains, combined with the terrain elevation and the pilot's personal minima, which should always be higher than the legal minima, the direct route was a no-go.
Did they consider alternatives?
The source mentions looking at, say, the desert road route, but that was also forecast to have cloud below the summit level. A coastal route might have been possible, but required careful checking of cloud bases against obstacle clearance requirements. If the forecast was slightly optimistic, they might not have had safe clearance.
The decision.
In that scenario, the safest decision based on a thorough assessment was likely not to go or to delay significantly and reassess.
It really highlights the danger of get-there-itis, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The pressure, often self-imposed, to complete a flight regardless of conditions. It's a major factor in weather-related accidents. Sometimes the right decision is to stay on the ground.
And it brings us back to the two biggest weather factors the source identifies in NZGA accidents.
Low-level visible moisture cloud, fog, precipitation reducing visibility below safe limits, and wind, particularly turbulence associated with strong winds and terrain.
So, quite a journey we've taken here, from decoding METARs and TAFs.
Through understanding pressure, wind, stability, cloud formation.
Exploring specific hazards like icing, thunderstorms, mountain effects.
And finally, applying it all to NZ weather patterns and making safe flight decisions.
Hopefully, this deep dive provides a solid shortcut to getting your head around the essentials of aviation weather.
The key is to integrate this knowledge. Remember how quickly weather can change here, especially near mountains. Plan thoroughly, check everything, and stick to conservative personal minimums.
And for a final thought to leave you with, think about those two major accident factors. Again, reduced visibility from low-level moisture and hazardous wind turbulence. How do they interact, particularly in a place like New Zealand with its mountains and maritime climate?
They directly attack the two things most fundamental to flight, the ability to see and the ability to control the aircraft. Understanding that connection, how low cloud and strong turbulent winds often go together here, is key to assessing the real risk, whether you're planning a flight or just watching the weather roll in. Something to keep in mind.